Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Remember, you can sign up for our daily podcast. It's free, and you can hear the program at your convenience on your computer or hopefully conflict-free portable device. Sign up for the podcast at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And now a slight correction. During Wednesday's segment about how poker terms have crept into the common lingo, take a listen to what I said. Whether or not we play, we all seem to be fluent in the vernacular. It's used every day. In fact, here's NPR's Mara Liasson from this morning talking about President Obama's Afghanistan speech.
But now, with his new surge in Afghanistan, President Obama has doubled down on a war he argues is still one of necessity, not choice.
So that was Wednesday, and many of you wrote in to point out that Mara Liasson, NPR's chief political correspondent, was actually not using poker vernacular in my example. Double down is, in fact, a blackjack term, meaning you are doubling your bet on a somewhat risky situation. I thought it had to do with poker betting. So I apologize to you, and I apologize to Mara Liasson. That said, I still contend that her copy may have been better off using a poker analogy. So we've actually rewritten that bit of her report with poker-appropriate language. First, we'll play her original blackjack-related clip again.
But now, with his new surge in Afghanistan, President Obama has doubled down on a war he argues is still one of necessity, not choice.
But we could pokerify that copy. She could have said, but now, with his new surge in Afghanistan, President Obama has bet the pot, hoping to draw a full house on the river, despite having a ducks in the hole for a war that he argues is still one of necessity, not choice. I guess that doesn't work as well, actually. We'll let Mara write her own copy, and we'll continue to try to raise the ante when it comes to the accuracy of our analogies. And from the old game of poker to the newest games of the 21st century and why they mattered in the O's. This will be about the industry and also about the ways in which video games as a cultural force reflect our interests, fears, hopes, and so on. And already today on our comments page about this, JLS wrote in to say that asking what video games in general reflect about our culture is a huge and insane question. I warn any potential respondent to first consider if they could explain what any other medium reflects about our culture. Well, maybe JLS, but that's just the point. We do talk about how movies or music or literature reflect our culture all the time. Why not video games? Joining us now is Mike Snyder, who writes about digital entertainment for USA Today. Mike, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. I hope I can meet up with your listeners' expectations here.
Well, and going right to that question of how games jibe with our fears and hopes and so on, do you think that video games have tended to presage cultural trends or reflect them after the fact? In other words, have video games been a leading or a lagging indicator?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both going on, but I think in a way the video game industry kind of doesn't presage things the way a movie industry might, in that because a game costs so much and there's so much bet, so to speak, on a product, they don't want to go too far out because they won't get a return. However, recently the time difference between what's happening in the real world and what might be broached in a game is shortening. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about a game that came out last month called Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, in which there's a level of the game where you actually, you know, there's a terrorist incident done against civilians and you are part of it. That wouldn't have been made, you know, several years ago. And now it's, you know, it brings up the whole discussion of what can games do, what should they do, and what players should do or feel when the game is going on.
Right. That's a controversial game because it
Certainly.
Features the player assuming control of a deep cover CIA agent, joining a group of Russian nationalist terrorists enacting an airport massacre. And they're essentially asking you to take part in the killing of innocent civilians, even though obviously it's just simulated in a game. What do you make of these controversies? Is it that the video game industry is just trying to push the shock value, or is it an art form testing its boundaries in the same way that film or music might have over the decades?
Well, I think in this game's case, I don't think it's just they're not just going for shock value. The people that made this game take it very seriously, and what they wanted to do was put the player in a position that theoretically there are, you know, operatives out in the real world that may have to make that decision, you know, as part of their job. And for those who haven't played the game and, you know, and are interested, in, you can actually go through that level and not shoot anyone. I mean, you, in fact, the first time I played it, I kind of just walked along with the terrorists and didn't really do anything. 'Cause the game, it kind of goes along, it goes on by itself. And in the end, the level ends, and once something's going to happen, and you don't really affect it because it's part of the story plot. And someone who buys the game can kind of skip this level if they want to. I haven't seen how that works. Mm-hmm. You know, the story somehow it fills you in. Mm-hmm. But it is a very unsettling level, and I think its goal, that was the goal. And I talked with the composer who worked on the game, who's a famous film composer, Hans Zimmer, and he said he really tried to put music to that that evoked a feeling of unsettledness. I mean, you get a bad feeling in your stomach as this is happening.
Did you finally become comfortable with pulling the trigger and taking innocent virtual life?
Well, when I played the game the second time, I did shoot a couple people just to see if the end of the level changed at all. It did not. I think there's a suspension of belief here, kind of like if you go to a film and you see bad guys, you know, shooting good guys. You know, you're a hero or a supporting hero is killed. You get an emotional impact there.
Right, but you don't have to make active choices to act.
True.
Watching a movie. Listeners,
true.
We just have a few minutes for this, but are you a gamer? What's been the biggest gaming trend of the decade for you? What game has been most influential or reflected cultural trends the most as you see it? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What's been the biggest gaming trend of the decade for you, and which ones do you think have been the most influential or reflected our country? 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. And I wonder, and my guest is Mike Snyder, who reviews digital entertainment for USA Today. How do we reconcile the fact that one big storyline of video games this decade has been how complex they've become, both in terms of graphics and narrative, like in the game we were just describing? But just as big a storyline is the success of the Nintendo Wii, which is an extremely easy-to-use system, generally presents you with innocent games like tennis or bowling, and has a huge following. Are these conflicting trends?
Well, I think what's happened is, one, video games have grown up, and they've become more socially acceptable. They're not teenage boy things anymore. In fact, the average game player is 35 years old. Now, ironically, you know, the first Nintendo system came out in the U.S. in 1985, and those people that played them in their teens are in their 30s now. So you've got a group of people who've grown up playing games, and they consider them as worthwhile pursuits right along with movies and books and television. Then as more people, and then maybe they pass this on to their kids. Now, as more people in the population play games, people that weren't playing games are exposed to them, and they go, well, maybe I'll give this a try. And Nintendo, you know, because of competition from Microsoft and Sony, kind of tried to, you know, leapfrog them in kind of a emotional way and a physical way with the Wii. And, you know, Nintendo historically has always kind of been a family-friendly game option. They do have games that are, you know, right, on their systems that are teen or mature rated.
Sure, but they were Super Mario and all of that.
Yes, and you know, what they really tapped into was this idea that a game controller is very intimidating to people who haven't played games. You know, you've got X's and Y's and things like that. But the Wii remote, you know, goes past that, and you can just move your hand, and it, you do, there's a little indoctrination, but you move it, and it, things happen on the screen, and that right. is appealing.
And, of course, you stand up to play the Wii. Whoever thought you would make a game that people would stand up to play in their own homes in the era of couch potatoes? Daniel in New Jersey, you got a favorite game in the last 10 years?
Yeah, yes, I do. It's a sub-game of Half-Life, and it's called Counter-Strike. It's a first-person shooter, and I've been hooked on it for the past 10 years. It's great, and it's only gotten better. So.
What makes it great as it compared to any other shooter game?
It gives you the role. I think it was the first of its kind that gave you the role of being a counter-terrorist. You were a special operative that had to prevent terrorists from attacking something important.
Daniel, also very much reflecting our times, very much a post-9/11 game. And David in Brentwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
So I wanted to talk about MMORPGs, the massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Mm-hmm. World of Warcraft is probably the biggest one.
Right.
But I think that gaming space has shaped, you know, the community more than anything else, because it's a place where people can go and actually hang out online and talk to each other. You know, they'll spend 7 or 8 hours a night communicating and not just playing a game, but actually creating a social network and gaming at the same time.
Absolutely. And, David, maybe that is the trend of the decade. Mike Snyder, the community building and the massively multiplayer games?
Yes, but this community building goes beyond massively multiplayer games. Music games like Rock Band and Guitar Hero are, you can get together physically or you can get together online. The Wii games are stand up and play with a group. You can have four people like they're at a bowling alley playing together.
And then, and those are physical. You get together instead of virtually. You get together in your living room and play the Wii together.
Certainly. There are some Wii games you can play online together. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, back when I was growing up, you know, my family would have card nights, you know, and couples would and friends would come over and play cards. Now people are playing games, whether it's online on the PC with World of Warcraft, you know, they get together to have Rock Band, Guitar Hero, you know, rocking nights, playing
yeah.
music at home.
Right.
That's kind of, you know, there are various generations of people that this is their form of social and community interaction.
And John says two big thrusts this decade, the massively multiplayer games and immersive environment games. Hi, John. What's that second one?
Hey, Brian. Really, like, if you look at Call of Duty 4, what he was talking about, that one level where you kill all those people, it's that you are really being put into the game. You're there. Like, it's exactly as, I just bought a brand new computer, and it's the most realistic thing I've ever seen, and I'm completely immersed in it. And, you know, it's just a matter of time until you can really immerse the senses in it completely. You know, they have that big, you know, cage where there's a treadmill underneath you where you put a helmet on and you're walking, and when you walk, it moves you in the game, and it's completely, that's what it's going to be. It's just a heightening mm-hmm. of realism mm-hmm. and a more immersive experience for the player.
Thank you, John. And unfortunately, we're not going to have time to take Nat in Manhattan, who says he's a 70-year-old who got hooked on Myst. But Mike Snyder, who reviews gaming for USA Today, digital entertainment for USA Today. You want to give us a last word in 20 seconds?
Well, interesting, your caller. You know, I've done stories on the Wii being a community get-together event in retirement communities. And they have Wii contests of bowling and other Olympic-type sports and things like that. So it's reaching across all ages. And, you know, I don't think it – video games are not a replacement for books or movies or anything like that. But they are certainly have grown in the last decade as an alternative form of entertainment.
And who knows what the teens will bring. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, and Paige Cowart produced this program. We had intern help today from Julia Ferlin. And our senior producer is Megan Ryan. That's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer.